Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Annie Raquel Lancelotto. Lancelotto is a poet, writer, musician, performance artist, and cancer survivor. She's the author of a book of poetry and several CDs, a solo work called Blue Pill with the Annie Lancelotto Band, and a collaboration, Carry My Coffee, with cellist Lori Goldston. She made her acting debut in 1993 with her solo show, Confessions of a Bronx Tomboy, My Throwing Arm, This Useless Expertise. Her most recent endeavor is a truly original memoir called L is for Lion, an Italian Bronx butch freedom memoir, and it was published this month by SUNY Press. I'm talking to Annie Lancelotto by phone from her home in New York. Annie, thank you so much for joining us.
Tish, it's an honor. I'm honored to be with you.
Great. Now, listen, you have been writing about your life in many forms and in many mediums, like performance pieces. So what made you finally decide to write a memoir?
That's a good question. I think at the end of the day, I just really needed to finish this and get it out there. I wanted to communicate with my cousins in the south of Italy to give them the full extent of this American experience, like the truth of what happened after the 100 years that our family was separated after immigration in the early 1900s. And the book has not been translated yet, but, I just needed to do my part to get it out there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and you did a great job. It's a fascinating memoir. I'm so glad you did it. Now, let's talk about the meat of it. I mean, you're one of four kids growing up in the 60s and 70s, an Italian family in the Bronx, and you describe yourself as a tomboy. Tell us more about that.
You know, the women were beasts of burden where I grew up. And so I was male-identified early on. And the life of the house happened at the dining room table where my father sat, and he did his work from there. He ran his oil business from the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I would sit with him, and I really learned the beginning of all my life lessons at that maple table, listening to conversations, and I sat underneath the table with the dog.
So yeah.
I would overhear what the adults were talking about. And the table was, the hub. It was really the first. There's a few central locations for me as a tomboy in that neighborhood. One was under the table, and then the next was the front stoop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And from the front stoop, I overlooked all the street action. And then as I got a little older, 5 years old, 6 years old, I was allowed on the sidewalk. And then in the middle of the street where the boys played stickball.
Yes, I love the way you describe that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty magical. I mean, we played in the street, and the cars understood that. The cars were part of it. You know, the cars were the bases of the game. And the moving cars understood you don't interrupt the play. it's like a foreign concept now, But that is the way it was back then.
You know, I want to ask you this, too. Your father called you Daddy. Where did that come from?
Yeah, what do you think of that? I don't know. I mean, I took it in stride as a kid because it felt like, oh, you belong to me and I belong to you. You know, it gave me a strong sense of, like, ownership over him in a one-on-one way. But, I thought it was a term of endearment, like mommy, poppy, sometimes another. In like ethnic neighborhoods, you'll hear different terms of endearment like that. But I know people react to it like they never heard it. So it wasn't until people reacted to it, like readers and stuff, that I thought anything of it, to be honest with you.
Really? I thought it was because your father sort of thought you were a son instead of a daughter,
I think you're probably right. I mean, the adults definitely treated me with an androgyny, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, like a son, you're right. He wasn't as brutal to me as he was to the boys in the family, but I did feel like a boy a lot. I didn't feel like a little girl.
Yeah, yeah, you make that really clear. Now, you actually begin this memoir talking about the fact that your father was a wife beater. He was very violent. Can you tell us how you coped with that?
Well, I didn't breathe, number
mm-hmm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't breathe. I still hardly breathe, really. I was terrified. School, in terms of coping, school, drawing and writing. Like, I began drawing pumpkins and apples and things on the table.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of coping, I tried to stop it. Like, I would hide teaspoons behind the heat pipes in the Bronx. And other urban neighbors, we had those silver heat pipes
mm-hmm.
that go through the whole house. And so it was a common thing if you tapped on the pipe, it was a code to the neighbors. and there were different codes, you know, like you want coffee, you want to, but I would tap, call the cops. In other words, I'd bang on that pipe. I remember once my mother said, "Where's all my spoons?" I guess she didn't realize that I, you know, this is, I'm talking 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I hid spoons behind each pipe.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I coped. I got sick a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I also kind of kept my father very close. I didn't want to be on his bad side.
Yeah.
He wasn't the type of guy you wanted to be on his bad side.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you seem in the book to have reached an understanding for him, if not a forgiveness. Is that true?
That's a really good question. You know, I mean, I always loved my father. So that love was always there.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time in life when I wanted, I mean, you know, I buried him now 12 years ago,
mm-hmm.
13 years ago. He's in a military cemetery, and, you know, that's where he wanted to be, with the soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I do understand now more about post-traumatic stress disorder that's untreated and what, you know, how soldiers suffer. And my father left a lot of writing behind. In the writing of my book, I uncovered some of his manuscripts. You know, my aunts, he had four sisters, and he had left some of them, some of his notebooks, and where he wrote for, in a mental home for a decade. And he said, you know, he said to my Aunt Tessie, "Save these, maybe Annie's going to write a book one day." And she handed me what was a memoir of growing up in the Bronx, being an Iceman in the days of the Icemen, and then going off into the Marines in 1945 and being shipped to Okinawa. You know, it's quite a read, and I want to do something with it, you know, to see what I could do with it.
Yeah. Well, your mother finally left your father in 1974. Then that was a huge change for your life, wasn't it?
It really was. You know, I left everything I loved, and I kind of felt ripped out of a place where I felt I belonged.
Mm-hmm. You guys moved from the Bronx to Yonkers, right?
Yeah, you know, it's only 10 minutes, but the Bronx, if you moved, or, you know, New York in general, if you, like, you identified by your block.
Mm-hmm.
I've read memoirs of people that they didn't want to move to the next block because it had a whole different identity.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, you know, you could hear my accent. Like, moving to Yonkers, I felt foreign, you know, and right away people identified my accent and started, you know, I don't want to say making fun of me, but, you know, poking fun, like, or, you understand, like,
yeah.
They.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the kids saying, you know, listen to her say water, listen to her say corner, listen to her, you know, say water, say water, say yo, say what's up,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And so it was an identity that I mean, in the Bronx, I was just one of the smart kids. Now all of a sudden, I was one of the dumb, cute Bronx kids.
Yeah, put on display, sort of, huh?
Yeah, like, just because of, like, the stereotypes, like the Fonz or the John Travolta characters, you know, like the dumb, cute characters, kind of,
mm-hmm.
you know. I didn't realize what was happening, but it, you know, it was odd.
Mm-hmm.
It was like put on stage.
Yeah. Well, you have to have felt something about the fact that really quite young you started to have feelings that you were attracted to women, too. That must have been incredibly difficult coming from a big Italian Catholic family. So tell us
yeah.
a little bit more about how that felt in the early days.
Well, you know, well, after college, after I had my first cancer, I had a lover kind of come back to Yonkers and live with me and my mom for a while. So I didn't really come out. I just kind of brought someone home, you know. And we had a good time. You know, we had a great time. We became family. But, you know, then my eldest brother calls me up one day. He says, "I want to take you for a ride." Now, in a Bronx context, that's like a cool thing. You know, first your older brother, and secondly, just let's go. You know, let's go for a ride. Like, you cruise around.
Uh-huh.
You know, I grew up kind of cruising around in cars. So I was excited because he never said that before. But little did I know, I got in his car alone. And anyway, so I got in his car. It was a Lincoln Continental. I heard all the locks go, you know, lock me in. The windows went up, the electric windows. And he just zoomed up the block and he said, "You know, I know what you are." And he started, you know, ranting, like, "Stay away from my kids, don't bring nobody over my house," you know, that kind of thing. And it was horrible. I mean, it felt, you know, the word spew came up for me. It was like a word I had read in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the earth will spew you up, you know, the Bible says about homosexuality. And I had just come off chemo, and, you know, I knew what to spew was, like to really vomit when you got nothing left. And I felt like that's, you know, I felt like an outcast.
Mm-hmm. And that's the first time you ever felt that, and it was from some member of your own family. That's what must have been so startling for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a common experience, right? I mean,
oh yeah.
There's a movie out called Trembling Before God, directed by my friend Sandy Dubowski, and it's about Jews and homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And then he did A Jihad for Love, and A Jihad for Love is about Muslims and homosexuality in different countries. And, you know, people get arrested, they have to leave their country. I mean, I didn't have an extreme experience like that.
Well, we have to talk about one of the most amazing stories in the book, for me at least. When you went to a boardwalk artist on the Jersey Shore and had them paint a portrait of you, which turned out to show your yet undiagnosed cancer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you like that story because it's
do.
An artist?
It's amazing.
Well, I was 18 and I had never been on vacation. And a buddy from my softball team took me to the Jersey Shore. And it was before I was going off for college to leave my family for the first time in my life. And so as a present for my mother, I sat down for one of those boardwalk portrait artists. Her name was Rhoda Shapiro. You know, I'll never forget. I gave her my last nickel. I came home with this pastel portrait. I was excited to buy my mother a gift. You know, I wanted to capture that moment of promise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that moment of, like, you're going off and you're at your best, right? Like, you just finished your college applications and I was in the sun for 2 weeks. Like, I felt a glow. And when my mother enrolled it, all she saw was that the artist had drew a lump on my neck. And no one else noticed it. Like, I didn't notice it. My friends didn't notice either the lump or the drawing, the lump in the drawing. And she just grabbed my neck. And, you know, it's amazing, a mother's vision, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was Hodgkin's disease. That was my first awareness of a problem.
Oh, that must have been so shocking. Were you scared at first? Did you say, no, Ma, that's nothing?
Yeah, right. No, you know, because I always had swollen glands, asthma. You know, so what's a lump? It's a swollen gland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's nothing. What could it be? It'll go away, you know. Let me ask you a question. I know you're the poet laureate of Ithaca and you're, you know, a phenomenal poet. From a poet's point of view, like, did any of the language strike you?
Oh, in your book?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I was thinking, you know, and I had to go back to find out that you're a poet because that isn't really underlined in your biography. So I had to go back and look and see, because a lot of the language does seem poetic to me. Yes, indeed.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
But tell us about this horrible adventure in the world of cancer. I mean, you ended up having to go to Sloan Kettering, and you were there for a long time. Talk to us about how that changed you.
Well, you know, I went off to Brown as a freshman, and then 2 months later, I was in Sloan Kettering. And so Sloan Kettering became my college.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the doctors were the most brilliant people I ever met, the most compassionate. You know, I was so lucky and so privileged to get this, you know, elite medical care. And I was young and strong enough as an athlete that they just blasted me with treatment. You know, they just took out the big guns to get rid of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a giant tumor crawling around in my chest, and they did everything to get it out. You know, the family was united again. All the fights started happening in the hospital. It was the first time everyone was together since the divorce, my parents and my siblings, and my siblings had children. So, and it was the beginning of the 80s. You know, AIDS had not yet been named. You know, mm-hmm. Sony Walkmans had not yet come out. You know, it was just happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a moment in, I think, history that really interests me. I mean, the AIDS movement, and even in the hospital, like, everything changed. Once AIDS was named and all these young gay extended families, I want to say, were in the emergency rooms, like all these young, you know, handsome men. And I mean, everything changed.
Yeah.
All the artists in New York were in the hospital. Like, it was what a time to come out. You know, what a time to come out. It was frightening. Nobody knew anything about blood or about In my surgeries, I had had all blood that was never screened, just New York City blood.
Mm.
You know, it's interesting being in a big city. Like, we New York City water, we always talk about the drinking water, and the blood supply is, you know, it's intense, you know? Like, you're part of something that, you know, you're drinking this water that millions of people are drinking, and it's traveled hundreds of miles through tunnels and, you know, pipes, and then you're getting this blood that's from this big pool of humanity. And, you know, it's a wild thing, I got to say. And I remember coming out as a lesbian, and in the ACT UP, in the AIDS movement, I remember people drawing maps of who they had, you know, relations with, because you had to figure out who you were connected to.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember these elaborate maps being drawn. You had to trace, you know, your contact.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Annie Lancelotto. We're talking about her book, L is for Lion, an Italian Bronx Butch Freedom Memoir. And Annie's talking about the fact that she was diagnosed with cancer at the age of 19. Now talk to us about the fact that you did so many unusual things, because you were longing for knowledge. And a lot of the times you were getting BS from the doctors. You actually put on doctor's coats, snuck into closets, and went down to the medical library. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there was an interesting moment when my brilliant doctor, who was always very straightforward with me and told me what I needed to know, he said, "We don't know what to do. You know, the tumor plateaued." That's like the word you never want to hear in a medical diagnosis. You don't want to hear plateau,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I was, you know, I was stunned, because he was godly to me. I thought he could do anything. So anyway, he told me that he was going to the tumor board, which is this huge meeting of all the minds at this cancer center. And he was going, like, on a stage and putting up my x-rays and asking the crowd of doctors what they thought, you know, he should do. And there was a big debate. So I asked him if I could be there, because he did treat me like a partner in my medical care. You know, I felt very respected by
mm-hmm.
him.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he said no. He said that's against medical etiquette for a patient to be in the room. So I went into a social worker's office. I took a white coat. I took a stethoscope. And, you know, I believe in full access, whatever you got to do. Right? I mean,
do
come
too.
On.
Yes.
You know, and all right, so I showed up. I had a clipboard. I had, like, these fake eyeglasses. You know, I was all set. So, you know, it's very interesting. Once you put on a white coat, nobody questions you in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's crazy. You could go anywhere.
And you were only 19 years old or something, right?
Yeah, but, you know, hey, doctors are young, you know, interns, uh-huh. there's all kinds of people in white coats.
Right.
So, but I really did respect my doctor, so I didn't want to pull one over on him. But I wasn't going to let him tell me I couldn't be there, so I wrote a speech, you know. The nuns had got me started on being an orator. I always had a speech ready wherever I was going. And I said, look, if he really says no, I'm going to speak, and I'm going to take over this whole room and tell them I'm not going anywhere. You know, they're going to have to drag me out. There was about 300 doctors in the room, nurses, whoever. So I went out in the hallway, and he laughed when he saw me, because I waited for him coming down the hall. And he said, all right, sit in the back of the room, and I sat in the back of the room.
I think that is such a great story. I love it. I love your your audacity.
Well, you know, I mean, I was alone. There wasn't, like I said, it was pre-AIDS movement. So there wasn't a community of activists for any disease that I could pinpoint.
Yeah, well, I still think people need to advocate for themselves.
It's true. You're still alone out there.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
It's wonderful, though, if you could find a peer group, a chat mm-hmm. room, a support system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's wonderful if you could ask other people with that disease, what's going on,
exactly.
what do you do,
yeah.
who's your doctors, what should I do,
yeah.
you know.
There are a lot more resources now. Now, Annie, but before we do run out of time, you have to talk to me about your amazing Grandma Rose.
Oh, Grandma Rose.
She lived to be 100 years old. She was amazing.
Well, at 99, they wanted to cut off her leg, and I said no. I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I got to do something. And we covered her leg with garlic, crushed with oil, your listeners could do this. You make a poultice out of garlic. And we covered the leg and wrapped it in a cotton pillowcase every night. And we held our hands heat over the leg and would pray and sing and chant. Anyway, she walked out of the hospital.
That's an amazing story, too, because she was suffering from, you know, lack of circulation. And
well, she was 100. She was 100 years old.
Yeah.
So she made it, you know. So she lived and died with her two legs on. She was 100 and a half, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, I'm going to plant a tree in her honor. I'm going to collect money from the family. Well, you can't collect money. Forget about the family and all that, right? So then outside my mother's window, my mother lives in a little apartment over a garage, over this, like, giant parking garage. My grandmother used to throw her peach pits out the window. She'd eat peaches, spit them into her hand, and throw the pits out the window. A peach tree grew a few months after she passed.
That's an amazing story, too, Annie.
Yeah. And so now I'm in charge of this tree. I prune the tree. I pick, you know, it gives 1,000 peaches on a good year. We bake all year long, peach pie, cake, whatever. So, you know, now I'm harvesting this one tree. It's
and then do you call it Grandma Rose?
Yeah, I call it Grandma Rose. Everyone says, you know, how's Grandma Rose? They want to take a picture with Grandma Rose. But she, you know, it was a strong message from beyond where she said, look, you don't need money to plant a tree. Like you're American and you're mixed up about this.
Mm.
All you need is a connection to the soil. You know, she was a peasant farmer in Acqua Viva della Fonte, which is the south Greek coast of Italy,
mm-hmm.
You know, on the heel of the boot. And I guess I shouldn't say American. Maybe I should say urban.
Mm.
She would say American. She would call me, you know, educational girl, you know.
Yeah.
Like, in other words, you know, you read books.
She would say American, yes.
She would say American, but I could say, like, urban. In other words, if you're a farmer, you're a farmer. You understand, you plant a pit, maybe you get a tree.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't understand that. You know, I never understood that until she showed me, you know, from beyond. So,
yeah, what a great woman she was. Wow. Yeah, she really influenced your life as well, right?
She knew how to stay in the present moment. She knew how to take care of herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she was an adventurer. Look, she came here at 19. She left her family, never saw her mother and all them again. And, you know, made a life in the Bronx. And she always tried new things. She didn't want to hear about the past. She'd always say, tell me something new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell me something new. And she went out and bought tofu, you know, before any of us had it, when it came to the East Coast. She said, yeah, it's the Chinese and mozzarella, you know.
I love that.
She was an adventurer. You know, she was a real New York lady. You know, she really did it.
And
I think everyone, you know, I'm proud of her. She really did it.
Yeah.
Really, God bless her.
And you are her granddaughter, absolutely. Now you describe going to Italy, the land of all your ancestors, cousins, you know, and that you were overwhelmed with emotion by the art and the architecture. Tell us about those feelings.
Mm. Well, two different cultures, the North and the South, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the little enclave that my family's from,
mm-hmm.
Down south. In Florence, I was overwhelmed. I just stood there crying in the piazza.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, like, this experience where I felt like the whole piazza was swirling around me with all the sculptures and fountains. And this man ran up to me and he said, you know, perché piangere bellissima? He says, you know, why are you crying, my beautiful one? And I just said, you know, c'è un libro per capire tutto. Like, is there a book to help me understand? You know, isn't that interesting? I mean, I need a book to understand life.
And everything that was surrounding you, right? You wanted a book.
Yeah, isn't that strange? And I just, it was a strange thing to come out of my mouth. I guess that's my route to the world. I mean, my grandmother would make fun of me. She'd go, yeah, go make a few more pages.
Uh-huh.
You know, like as if it was useless because you can't eat it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, her world was like one of greens and, you know, go pick the wild greens on the side of the highway. And, you know, but if you couldn't eat it, it really wasn't useful to her. She didn't understand or have an appreciation for books or sports or, you know, She came from the peasant heart, you know, heart of the culture, mm-hmm. of the world, the connection. I mean, the peasant connects, the, you know, the divinities to the soil, and they started by divining the water. You know, where should we create this town?
Mm-hmm.
They found Acqua Viva della Fonte by divining water. It means living waters of the fountain.
That's beautiful, so, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they said here, we're going to start here. There's water under the earth here. We're going to find water here. And, you know, it's the beginning of a civilization, of a people, to mm-hmm. root to the earth. You know, it's she really had a sense of, you know, of the purpose of life, I think, of the meaning of life in a way that I just aspire to or yeah. one I'm in awe of.
Yeah.
And, you know, and my mother has some of that. Yeah. My mother's a very strong, strong Bronx lady.
And you, well, you did learn some of it and acquire some of it by going to Italy and connecting with that beautiful art there. I've been to Italy as well, and it's amazing.
Yeah, you know, you have to come back with the question, what can I make with my hands?
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Yeah.
Just my hands. You know, that's it. Or your however you relate to that,
yeah,
your heart, your hands, your you know, your feet, whatever, you know, what can I make?
Yeah, and listen, you said something in your book too. Let me quote it. It says, "I wanted to know what forces come together, what were the conditions around which human beings lived up to their creative potential." I love that.
Mm. That sounds good.
That's you wrote that.
Wow, I didn't even I don't even know what's in this book, Tish, to tell you the truth.
I can understand that. I mean, once I write a poem, I sort of let it go until I have to read it again, yeah.
Yeah, you have to sit and read it, right? Yeah. You have to figure it out.
Yeah. Listen, we are almost out of time. Can you tell me how your family has reacted to this book? What kinds of reactions you've gotten? How has it been received?
Well, we're working it out. You know, we're working it out.
Really? Were they upset about throwing family secrets into the great beyond?
Yeah, well, you know, when a woman speaks, you go against the grain. You know, you're not supposed to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't grow up in a culture where you were supposed to speak, especially women. So this, you know, I kind of did the big taboo. You know, I spoke, mm-hmm. and now it's on paper and out there.
And you've been doing that all your life.
Yeah, but now, you know, it's something that a book has its own body.
Mm-hmm.
It's less ephemeral than a performance for me. You know, a performance, you put it out there, who's in the audience is there. You know, now, of course, video, whatever. But a book really has its own body.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
well, it has a beautiful body, and it's out there.
I'm so glad it's out there. It's a beautiful book, Annie, and I'm so glad you wrote it. And I hope a lot of people will read it. We are almost out of time. Can you give some contact information that people can get in touch with you?
Sure.
Website?
lisforlion.com.
Well, great. Annie Lanzalotto, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called L is for Lion, an Italian Bronx Butch freedom memoir. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Tish, I love talking to you. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.